So if you wanted to say any more on that?
You know, I see, you know, I mean, I think it's difficult for them now. It's not, the distinctions are not as great as they used to be. There's not as much tradition, I think, in terms of serving overseas as there was back in the 60s, early 70s. Their projects are, I see the most of their projects now are related to, or at least a lot of their high priority projects relates to AIDS, HIV infection, et cetera. And that's, I mean, I think it's necessary. I don't think there's any doubt about it, but it's not the kind of project that I feel affinity to. I feel more affinity to community development, agricultural development types of things. I'd like to see them go back into Vietnam if they could. I'm sure they would like to, if they could. I think that would be a very unique experience. But in general, I mean, it's an organization which I think has made a definite contribution and continues to try to. I mean, I support them 100%. They're an excellent organization. I hope my kids would try to do something like that, similar, IBS or something similar. I mean, it provides an experience which changes your entire life, which changed mine dramatically.
I'll get to that.
Whoops.
Thank you for mentioning it, but not quite yet.
Okay.
If you had to say what the IVS mission statement might have been when you were a volunteer, what might that have been?
From my perspective, and I'm not sure if this is really a statement on a mission statement, but it was to work with the local community in a very unobtrusive way. I'm not sure that's part of a mission statement, but it is. To be as unobtrusive as you can, and yet to be as helpful as you can in a humanitarian effort to improve the local structure and cohesiveness of the Vietnamese community that you lived in. That would be very all-inclusive. And that was not, I do think that the people that were teachers of English, they were kind of different. You know, I don't think they went in for that social warm fuzzy types of statements. They enjoyed their students. They had, you know, they taught them English.
Sometimes science,
history,
too.
Yeah, science, history. They got an international exposure, which they wouldn't have otherwise, which
True.
Clearly is very important.
Mm-hmm.
I think they changed a lot of people's lives. But they were into a very limited segment. Or at least, not all of them were that way, don't get me wrong. But, I mean, they were into the educational high school, college core of Vietnam. That's where they were.
Yeah.
And the ag people, and I used to think the ag people were a lot more conservative than the community development people, and that may be true. I don't know if it's completely true. That was a little bit of a prejudice maybe on my part. But I think we were more involved, or at least I was personally more involved in trying to be as unobtrusive as possible, and yet to not let war completely destroy where I mean, you know, what impact did I have? You know, probably pretty damn minimal when you think about it. But you know, at least you tried to say and do things that provided validity to the Vietnamese structure, cohesiveness, etc.
Yeah,
and that was my mission statement.
Yeah,
and I think IVS was its leadership was enough to recognize that that's what I did and what I did well, and they let me do it.
maybe not for yourself, but for IVS as a whole. In terms of that mission statement, how closely did they achieve that goal? And if they fell short, what were the reasons for the shortcomings?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay.
I don't think I can make a judgment. I can talk about individuals.
Uh-huh.
But I don't.
But not the organization as a whole.
I wasn't part of that.
All right. Well, I'm going to put it a little differently.
Okay.
That may be, more concrete to grapple with. Was there a point at which you saw, this is a retrospective look.
Obviously.
Where now you see that IVS maybe should have ended its involvement in Vietnam. Because the war context may have made anything they were trying to do either impossible or took a toll on volunteers, not necessarily in terms of death or injury, but in terms of their frustration and ability to do things. And maybe it would have been better just to say, okay, we're not taking any more, and we'll just phase out everyone else.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so at all. I think that if my mission statement is reflective of at least a portion of the organization, that if you have people that are smart enough and wise enough, things go in cycles.
Uh-huh.
And there was a concern that the period following the 2 years that I was there, that the organization became too pro-government, that there wasn't that degree of confrontation with the American government that there had been in the past. But I think that would have sealed its fate in many ways.
Yeah, let me see if I understand you correctly by repeating if
sure.
I can. Kind of the active listening stuff. This was after you left.
No.
Oh, while you were still there.
After, when I first started, the agency was clearly pro-Vietnamese culture, anti-American war effort, okay?
Right.
All right.
The residual of the resignations and the spirit of that.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was something that I was, I was kind of proud to be associated with. And there were a lot of people that felt that way.
Right.
Well,
there were a lot of people who signed on that letter.
Yeah.
I mean, not you guys, because you were just coming in. And they actually told people who were within their, I think, first 6 months, that they didn't want them to sign because they didn't have the context.
Well, I wasn't there.
No, but I mean, even people who had been there for
a
few months, they said, we don't want you to sign this. We're just telling you what we're doing. Didn't even ask for signatures. Yeah, they didn't even ask for signatures from many volunteers if they thought they hadn't been there enough to clearly sign in good judgment. They didn't want to stampede. I thought that was remarkably...
Well, they were
integrity.
Yeah, well...
but look who did it.
Yeah. and I think Dan Whitfield was brought in because he was a much more conservative person.
Mm-hmm.
He got along with people. He was more of an administrator.
Uh-huh.
He was more of an agricultural development person. He had that perspective.
a little bit more conservative, middle of the road. He was clearly an American. I mean that in a negative way. He was still, his Vietnamese was flawless. I mean, oh, Lord have mercy. My God. I'd die for his Vietnamese. Just outrageous. I mean, he'd have Vietnamese just stuttering. I mean, they didn't know what to do. I mean,
it was too good.
It was too good. That man had, he had everything down. I still remember, I just sat there with my jaws open. So did the Vietnamese. But he was much more proper, I guess. He was not radical in any way, shape, or form. And he directed the organization in that way. And I think that's what they needed at that point, after all that instability. But I don't know, you know, maybe 73 to 75 was a time when, but I can see the organization having a commitment to the Vietnamese national sense of who they are, of their longevity, of their history, and saying that we are committed to that.
When you first arrived.
Even after, too.
And after.
That's the sense of the organization.
So that still continued under Whitfield.
Oh, yeah.
But he just provided some stability to the organization.
Yeah, and he wasn't radical. I mean, he was very non-judgmental. I think he was, I don't know if he was pro-USAID, but he had spent time with USAID, see. So there was that connection. And
yeah, between his volunteer experience
and coming back as cop, director, he was with USAID.
Yeah.
And they picked him for that reason.
Not
completely for that reason, but that was a very significant part of his background, that they wanted somebody in there that understood that USAID was not the devil reincarnate and attempting to find a commie under every nook and cranny, that they were, they had some people at least that were, not very many, but they had a few. And I, you know, that was, he was the man that provided the transition and stability and calmed USAID down. That's what he did.
Calmed USAID down?
I think so, yeah. Oh, USAID wanted IBS out big time.
Because of the disloyalty of the resignations.
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't part of all that, but I heard a lot about it. You know. There was a lot of political discussions going on in D.C. and Saigon, and, you know, obviously the agency came very close to being gone.
Of course, it did a few years later anyway.
Yeah.
But for at least that much longer, he did provide that stability.
And, you know, he did a good job.
Yeah, that's the sense I get.
And
just pause on this, but
that the volunteers, I mean, there was a real schism between the leadership and the volunteers. I mean, there were a lot of people that signed on to that letter, there's no doubt about it, but I think there were a lot that didn't as well. And I just think that the leadership and a sizable portion of the volunteers weren't seeing eye to eye.
The resigned leadership, you mean? And that poor Dan had to walk in on,
on
that and try to put it together.
I remember some speeches that he gave that were, you know, very good.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of points did he make?
Well, just in terms of trying to set a perspective on what your job is, trying to put behind this issue and focus on, you know, you're a new set of volunteers with a new, you know, you can define your future, you know, those kind of a pep talk. But I think it was very effective.
And then he had to deal with Ted Offensive.
Well, yeah.
I have a lot of empathy for the man.
Yeah,
I was up in Nankai.
Yeah, you didn't know.
I just know that we were going from 150 down to 50. Mm-hmm. I knew that. But how it happened, who went where, I found out after the fact. He came and saw me, made sure I was alive.
Yeah.
And
that's a nice thing.
And
mm-hmm.
We had a big conversation. He and Gene, was it Gene Stolfus? No, it wasn't Gene. Somebody came and talked to me and told me that they were shutting it down. I packed my bags and go. Wanted to know if I wanted to stay. I mean, they went over the whole thing with me.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember that.
Yeah. It's good they consulted. Honest brokers.
Yes, it was. And, I don't know why they decided to let me stay. I don't know why, but I think they had enough people who wanted to go at that time.
Partially.
That they had some openings.
Yeah. Yeah, and...
And I think that I had made some pretty good friends while I was there. I mean, I think they were willing to stand up and say, he's a volunteer that would be, if he says he wants to say, he means it, and you can trust that he's got fairly good judgment. You know, I think, I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah. As a kind of wrap-up, how has the IVS experience affected you?
Well... I think it's a reflection of a lot of different things that I've done. It clarified for me that I enjoyed that type of work. That, in general, as an overview, that social work is an honorable profession that I happen to have an affinity with. Therefore, I've continued in that kind of, when I did go to grad school, I was the first student at Michigan State University to mix anthropology and economic, international agricultural development. I volunteered in a lot of places. My last 20 years have been with social services.
And refugee resettlement.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, which we hadn't said on the tape, but you told me earlier, spending so many years resettling.
Yeah, about 12 years working as a director of the Refugee Assistance Program in the state of Michigan. Very, very rewarding. I was able to do things nationally, like I was talking about. Michigan was the first state to adopt a policy and to write policy that required that you had to consider an ethnically matched foster care home before you made an automatic assumption that it was going to be a white middle class house or foster home.
Rather than a Cambodian or Vietnamese house.
Right.
Yeah.
And that really took a long period of time to develop, but it culminated with my being on a national task force, and we wrote, I authored, other people helped, but it was my idea conceptually, and I did a lot of writing. For federal regulations that came out under HHS to require that that be the national standard that's used, and is still used today. I spent some time, I didn't mention to you, but I spent some time in D.C. working on the My Lai Massacre story.
Oh, you did?
With Seymour Hersh, yeah. And
What did that involve?
Well, I was there when it was breaking.
Was
with the people from the news agency called Dispatch News Services, the agency that carried an independent group that had people in Southeast Asia and a couple guys in Washington, D.C. And we were just checking out Vietnamese sources with my language capabilities. I had gone in front of Congress to testify in Kennedy's committee because IBS would send volunteers, you know, when you got back, you'd go up to the hill and talk to people. But we spent time. It was very interesting. I mean, we were under surveillance by the FBI and the CIA. Oh, man, it was really heavy. But we were in a lot of negotiations with CBS, NBC, and ABC, you know, about the rights and all that stuff. And I left because all it was in the end, were little fish doing the same thing the big fish do. You know, just.
What do you mean?
Yeah, making the money, you know, turning a profit.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, they were committed to the story, don't get me wrong.
Yeah. Know,
they really were.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the people that were in that, one of the guys, just they offered me a job there, and so I just said, no, I don't want to be associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not in D.C. Maybe I'll go work. I will overseas and send you stories, but
uh-huh.
I wasn't. I wasn't cut out to be a Washington mover and shaker. I just didn't like it.
Lansing's big enough.
Wherever. You know.
Yeah.
I try to. Low key is my preference. I just seem to take it easy.
Uh-huh.
Life's too hard to. Spend all that time trying to make money. Money comes anyway.
Yeah.
You're going to live as long as you live. You make it as long as you're going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's over with, so.
Yes. Very much over.
But, yeah, no, IBS, I mean, clearly Vietnamese and my, you know, my affinity with the culture has, you know, whatever, how long it's been now,
mm-hmm.
30 years, still... You know, I still deal with refugee issues. You know, this whole issue of welfare reform is coming up. And I'm one of the few voices that stands up in the management team meeting and says, well, you know, blah, 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 about this and that. And are we doing outreach to the community? You know, the community's sitting out there flipping out, wondering, you know, my father's here. Am I going to have benefits or not? You know, we need to begin to go out and contact people and... And they're just, you know, everyone's so concerned about getting out the new policy and meeting all the federal guidelines and, you know, they're not thinking of the impact on the community that,
uh-huh.
that's being affected by this. Maybe that's warm, fuzzy social work type of ideas, but I think it's valid.
Yeah.
And so I still fight for it.
Uh-huh. And it's part of the IVS experience. It doesn't doesn't sound like, well, someone who... had the poli-sci major wouldn't necessarily have gravitated toward that.
Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe not, but this definitely put you in that direction.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So it became professional as well as an experiential.
Yes, oh absolutely. Thing. Yeah, it was, I have spent a lot of time with people and always have said, you know, you ought to try the Peace Corps, you ought to try IBS. I mean, it clearly uh-huh. is an experience that you can't replace.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just impossible.
Uh-huh.
And I think everyone should, in this country, should be forced to go live overseas. I mean, it should be national service.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been opposed to the draft.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, I've always been opposed to volunteer army. I've always felt there should be a draft,
mm-hmm.
a universal draft for men and for women, and everyone should be required to provide 2 years of national service.
Mm-hmm.
I think the loss of the draft is probably one of the worst things that happened to this country because it allows for the creation of small mercenary wars
uh-huh.
in various locations.
Uh-huh.
Grenada, for example. You know, those kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
The only reason the Vietnam War stopped was the middle class. And you need the influence of the middle class on the military. You absolutely do.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that keeps it in check.
Uh-huh.
You know, sometimes we say, oh, the middle class doesn't know much, but I think the middle class is in reality probably the a major influence on political and military power.
Yeah, because right now it's just either elites or the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom who can see a job and who will be used.
Mm-hmm.
And then the wealthy who gain the defense contracts and the...
Yep.
The stars on the shoulder.
And it, you know, war makes the world go round.
Yeah. Any question that I didn't ask, which maybe I should have?
Well, I think we've talked around it a lot. Not around it, but we've talked about it off and on. And that was the and I wasn't direct, but I think, and we talked about it in the difference between IVS Laos and IVS Vietnam. I think it was the political aspect of the other, and we talked about that.
Okay.
I feel pretty comfortable with that.
Okay.
I'll probably think of something tomorrow.
Always. Riding off to work. Oh!
Why did I say that? Why
yeah, I should have had a V8 yeah. kind of response.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. After, I think I'm going to put this on this tape. But it was... You wouldn't know this person because she served in Laos, both she and her husband. But a woman named Carol Compton, who teaches Lao, actually, in the summers for a Southeast Asia language
mm-hmm.
thing that goes, spends 3 years in one university and then another and another, wow. and they bring in language training. You could go for Tagalog or Vietnamese or... Lao or Burmese or Indonesian Bahasa,
Whoa.
You know. And, you know, it's mostly for academics, but anybody. The next morning we were having breakfast, she and her husband and I. And she was thinking of her experience in Laos and particularly people in the forward areas. Which she and her husband were not,
mm-hmm.
Probably because her husband had her with him. You know, yeah. don't put a woman there.
I think it would be very difficult to go as a couple.
Really
do.
Yeah.
Clearly, it's a single person's job.
Yeah, for out there. But she was very passionate, and then in the next morning, and talking about the irresponsibility of the organization. As IVFs, to go off and put people in those situations, a real abrogation of their responsibility. And it was sort of organized originally by a fellow that was known as Colonel Hafner, working for AID, and apparently it had some sort of military background. And she put the responsibility squarely on...
On him?
No, not on him, because he's military, and he would behave like this, but... But for the civilian IVSers who were in charge and who should have known better.
I don't disagree with that at all.
No.
I
mean, neither do I.
They were blatantly fighting the war
mm-hmm.
on behalf of the Americans. Blatantly. I would have never been able to make it an idea false. I would have quit or been drummed out very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing I will, you know, IVS Vietnam was much more involved in the experience of cross-cultural communication, providing the opportunity of Americans to come to Vietnam. I mean, it was in many ways, maybe Gardner was right what he was trying to do, but he was wrong because if you didn't recognize the political nature of your being there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that incident where I covered that body, I mean, that was a gut reaction, but it was not a very smart reaction on my part. It put me in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot the principle that I had attempted to espouse before I went. You have to be able to shut yourself off at certain times to the horror of war,
mm-hmm.
and go on about your business. And that's the resiliency of the Vietnamese that were able to do that. And I'm not sure that Americans could do that. You know, some of the things that you would see just would be so unacceptable that you just couldn't, you can't fathom the pain that people must be going through. I remember one time where a Vietnamese woman was working in a base, and these Americans just started fondling her in front of her.
Go on.
And all these American GIs were just fondling her in front of everybody, you know, grabbing her in the breasts and the crotch and humping her and kissing her and just in front of all these other Vietnamese. And just the pain that this woman, I mean, and must have suffered. And yet the Vietnamese can, you know, at the same time, I spent a lot of time with the in this prostitute section on K when I first moved there, and they were, you know, I'm a prostitute. That's what I do.
Uh-huh.
But the Buddhist influence told them that the circumstances required them to be this way, and when the circumstances quit, they could go back to who they were. Well, they can't. But they were able to sort of rationalize what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
But this woman, this young girl was just, I mean, she was a charm. What, she was a charm. I remember her dress. She was a charm. And they just, you know, I mean, they just, in front of everybody, they just treat her like a piece of shit.
Uh-huh.
Worse. And that kind of degradation that you, you know, it's hard to get that out of your psyche. And, you know, those are the times when, you know, that's after I'd been there a while. I think if I'd have been earlier, I'd have gone up and said something to those GIs and got my ass just absolutely beaten up or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'd have hired somebody to come and get me. So you've got to be real. You've got to understand the context with which you're in and do what you can when you can and not go beyond that point. That's very difficult when you are as idealistic.
Uh-huh.
As I was at the time.
Yeah. That's all of the people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I mean, I just think that they gave me personally an opportunity that I would never have had any other way. I mean, it's irreplaceable.
Yeah.
And, you know, to this day, I am as comfortable in a group of Americans as I am in with Vietnamese. I mean, there is no distinction in my comfort level whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
And I feel as if that is part of my who I am.
Uh-huh.
And
you're still in deep.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And it amazes me that Americans still always think when you speak a different language, you're talking about them. I mean, there's just, there's so much parochialism in this country still. I had an incident the other day with it, you know, and I was getting off the elevator with a friend of mine, he's Vietnamese. And I said, well, you know, see you later, you know, hey, if you don't have anything to do this weekend, you know, come on up north. I said it in Vietnamese and walked away, because that's the language he and I use.
Sure.
And this woman that I know was getting off the elevator with me, and she had a piece of paper she wanted me to see in her office, so I said, well, you know, how about now?
Yeah.
Cool. And then she made an, you could sense her, and she made a joke about it. Well, were you, you know, what were you saying about me? You could just sense the uneasiness. And these are supposedly professional people in a social agency. And yet, I guess, what the heck? I mean, they have the same foibles, you know. But it's amazing that in 30 years, that's still persistent, you know?
I don't know about that. 30 years is not that long.
Well, long enough for me.
Yeah, well.
I mean, I don't feel uncomfortable when anyone's speaking a different language around me. It's just, it's normal. But that's the experience that...
Yeah, that comes from being in the context.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet, these people, you know, it's still very pervasive. People get very... You know, you would think... They wouldn't even think anything about it.
Well, it's getting a little bit late.
Yes, it is.
And you've got work tomorrow. Sorry to have to remind you.
Yeah.
I've got to get going too.
Okay.
We've got some addresses for you to get, and
we'll drive. I'll get Stu's tomorrow.
The consent form, and it's now. Oh, it's 10 after 12.
Oh, really? Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well.
So good night.
Good night.